Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 31st, the final day of 2021. Whoa. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a special, special, so special version of the Majority Report. It is the final day of the year, and we have our final best of 2021. Goodbye, 2021, we say.
Adieu.
See you not next year. Because next year we will see 2022.
Yeah, that's not how time works. Yeah. Sorry, you're dead now, 2021. Fuck yourself.
It really is an adieu situation.
I hated it.
It's an adieu situation and not an au revoir situation.
Yeah.
Bien sûr. Zut alors. Look at who speaks French.
Although I will say I did.
Wow, Matt, I'm really impressed. Nothing like whipping this out for the first time in 2021. Your proficiency in
it wasn't the first
French
time.
Idioms.
It would be, we discussed this in the Adieu Gate.
Yeah, remember Adieu Gate? Mm.
I don't remember anything from 2021. I'm going to my New Year's resolution for 2022 is going to be to attempt to remember things that happened within the prior week.
Mm.
Because I cannot do that now.
Well, I will say, 2021 was a bummer in many ways, right? Maybe not as bad as 2020, but I did enjoy our time on the show.
Yeah, all right. That's okay.
That was good for you. No, I'm joking.
I was going to say, yeah, good. That's great. That must be great for you. That's really good. We should probably talk about our New Year's resolutions on Monday, right? Not today.
Do you have New Year's resolution?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Not at the moment, but I've got a couple of things in the hopper I'm thinking about, maybe doing. Not sure exactly what that'll be. But
not sure if you want to resolve yet, but...
Yeah. We're pre-recording this, we should say.
Yeah.
It's not actually Friday the 31st for us. We pre-recorded this in September.
Yeah.
So we're just... and what was amazing is that even in September, we knew that the interview that we did in January of 2021, the rise of the modern Senate and the crippling of American democracy would be somewhat prescient. It is amazing to look back at the shows that we did in January of this year and realize all the things that we thought might be problems.
Yeah.
The COVID relief bill passed. I think everybody had a sense that that was going to happen. But all the good stuff that we wanted, not so much.
Not so much.
Not so much.
So much for Jan 6 booting bipartisanship out of the frame.
Yeah, no kidding. That did not happen. For whatever reason, the Democrats cannot seem to get past that. And when they did, then they realized it was too late. But here is Adam Gentleson, a really important understanding of the filibuster. It is conceivable by the time that we play this, there may have been some attempt or talk to reform the filibuster in the narrow, narrow instance of voting reform. I tend to doubt it, but it's possible. So I just want to put that caveat on there so that I'm safe on both sides. It's one of the sort of little tricks you learn in the trade when you're doing political prognostication is you say, I think this is going to happen,
or
the other thing could happen, so you've covered both potentialities.
Brilliant.
And yet, I will get credit for predicting, because it is true.
Who will give you credit?
Me? Because, like, if there is no reform to the filibuster, I'm going to say, like, I said that was likely to happen. But if there is reform to the filibuster, I said that was possibly going to happen.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, good that you, either way, you'll get to feel good about yourself. That's really all that matters.
Well, that could be my resolution for 2022.
Yep. Just lying to yourself. That's fun.
Delusion to make myself feel better. Also, an interview that we did with Rosa Brooks. She wrote a book, Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. It was a behind the blue wall of silence in the D.C. police. We did a book on them. And so we have both those. And then as an ultra bonus, David Feldman, the final Friday of 2021. David Feldman, who I have mixed feelings about when he comes on the show, as you know, because of his attitude and other things that can go nameless or unspoken.
Oh, well.
Yep.
I'm going to speculate.
Well, everybody will. That's part of it. So, folks, enjoy this. We are back live on Monday with a whole new attitude.
I don't know why you're promising that.
I won't be back.
What do you mean?
I have my vacation.
Are you serious?
Yeah, remember? No. I told you about this.
I totally forgot about that. You're not back next week?
No, the week of the 2nd. Yeah, I told you about this, remember? And you said it's totally okay. And that's part of why I'm hosting the show solo on the week before Christmas, because we're trading.
What? That is, well, I guess it's part of the new attitude. Like, do whatever you want to do.
I guess. That's my New Year's resolution.
Freestyle. Whoa. All right. Okay. Well, then I guess we'll see you on Monday. Just saunter in whenever you feel like you feel like it.
Yep.
See you then. All right. Well, folks. Everybody here who cares about you in 2022 will be here on Monday. And then
to greet the new year with you.
Yeah, to greet the new year.
Yeah, well.
You're going to come back to work on the 7th or wherever as you decide to breeze in, and you're going to be like, what's going on?
It's going to be a whole new momentum.
So much, and it's like,
someone going to be sitting in this seat?
I don't know.
I guess that's part of the freewheeling attitude.
Maybe that seat won't even be here. Maybe we'll just be like, remodeled the whole office.
That'll be the gaming station.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn.
Sorry.
Damn.
Folks, have a happy new year. We will see you in 2022. Want to welcome to the program the public affairs director from Democracy Fund, former senior aide to Senator Harry Reid, the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam Gentleson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Adam, I'm very excited to have you here, in particular on this day. And to some extent, you know, I think what we anticipated when we booked you has changed just a little bit. I want to talk about the filibuster, and what you've written in the book and the history of the filibuster. It's fascinating. There was stuff in there, as much as I've been sort of decrying the filibuster for years, there was stuff in there I did not, quite realize. And I found it a great read. And then obviously I want to talk about, report today that Joe Biden is going to supposedly eschew a reconciliation, and try and get a bipartisan deal. But let's talk about this history of the filibuster. You basically break it down into two different eras. The first essentially coming from more or less around Reconstruction through to the Civil Rights Act. And give us a little bit of history of this. What I found amazing that I found from your book was that every deployment of the filibuster during that time, that some 80 years, I guess it was, more, was to stop civil rights legislation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we know, you know, we have a vague sense that the filibuster was associated with segregation, with efforts to stop civil rights. You know, President Obama has called it a relic of the Jim Crow era. But, you know, that's not just an association. That was its primary and exclusive purpose. It was, you know, dating back to the beginning of the Senate, the filibuster was not part of the original Senate. The founders did not include it in the Senate. The Senate was a majority rule body and obstruction was looked down upon in the original Senate. And it was only after the intervention of John Calhoun in the middle of the 19th century that the filibuster really began to come into existence as we know it today. But it wasn't until the 20th century that the filibuster could be applied in the way we know it today, where it is used to raise the threshold to pass a bill from a simple majority to a supermajority. And the way it became honed in this method was by being used to block every civil rights bill that came before Congress from the end of Reconstruction in 1877 all the way through 1964 when Lyndon Johnson finally broke a Southern filibuster. So this wasn't incidental to the filibuster. This was how it was used. This was how Southern senators brought it into existence, and it became a normal part of Senate life because civil rights and the continued oppression of Black Americans was the only issue that provided enough motivation for senators to make this massive innovation and change the shape of the Senate.
I mean, this is, you know, that was, and I want you to just talk a little bit about John Calhoun, because I think, you know, some time ago, I guess now it was, we had Nancy McLean on to talk about Democracy in Chains, which covers a lot about John Calhoun, but give us a sense of who this guy was and the context in which, I mean, because your book is The Crippling of American Democracy. And on some level, it was pretty lame. There was a certain, you know, there was a lameness to the democracy as it, you know, when it started, particularly when we're talking about the Senate, right? I mean, this is a...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
Democratic body.
That's right. I mean, the Senate has always been an anti-democratic body. But I think the thing about that is that that's often used to overlook the fact that it was more democratic in its original conception than what it has become today. Even as a very deeply anti-democratic body, it was never supposed to be as anti-democratic as it is today. And John Calhoun was the originator of the trend that brought us to where we are today. James Madison, who's often cited as sort of the leading protector of minority rights among the founding fathers, never intended the Senate to have a filibuster, and he certainly never intended the Senate to have a supermajority threshold that almost every bill had to clear. The person who wanted it to be that way was John Calhoun. And so Calhoun was in the Senate starting in the 1830s. This was around the time Madison passed away. All of the other framers were dead. And Calhoun started to innovate the filibuster. He used it exclusively to advance the interest of slavery and to protect the planter class, who were his main benefactors as a senator from South Carolina. So he created the Senate where a minority could have a veto over everything the majority wanted to do. And he was explicit about this. He wrote a tract called A Disquisition on Government that was published right after he died. And he said that he didn't think the framers put in enough protections, and Calhoun wanted any minority faction in the country to be able to exercise veto over anything that passed. So the Senate basically for 200 years was caught in a battle between the Madisonian vision, where there was a lot of debate, but eventually a majority would have its way, and the Calhounian vision, where a minority could block anything that passed. It took about 200 years, but part of what the book argues is that Calhoun won. The Senate we see today, McConnell's Senate, is a Senate where a minority of 41 senators who can represent as little as 11% of the population can exercise veto power and block anything the majority wants to do. That is the culmination of John Calhoun's vision of the Senate.
We should be clear here that when we talk about a minority, particularly in the context of Calhoun, but really, I mean, until this day, the minority that we're talking about in blocking these things is really, I mean, the functionally the aristocracy, or at least the moneyed elite in this country, right? I mean, it's the moneyed, it's the powerful, it's those people who, the few who are ruling the many. And it is, and the idea of extending, I guess, American democracy to non-white people was sort of like the tip of the spear, as it were, in terms of like opening up and democratizing our country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we should be careful with our terminology here. When I say minority, I'm talking about minority in the sense of the top 1%. This is not about protecting vulnerable racial or ethnic minorities. You know, Calhoun, the great American historian Richard Hofstadter, called Calhoun the Marx of the master class. So Calhoun only deployed minority protections to protect the overdog, not the underdog. And what he saw was that this minority was losing out. You know, he was operating at a time when it was becoming increasingly obvious that America wanted to move away from slavery. They weren't, you know, incredibly enlightened, but the Northern economic model was proving dominant. Even, you know, in the antebellum times, there was a prevailing sense that slavery was a necessary evil. A lot of the argument that they made was that slavery was bad for white people because it debased them and taught them bad habits. So, you know, we're not exactly talking you know, enlightened thought here. But nonetheless, slavery was losing out, and the slaveholding class was a minority. Calhoun needed to find a way to increase the protections and the power of the minority within our system of government. And in order to protect, you know, the planter class, the elite, the wealthy, and preserve the oppression of Black Americans, that is why he invented the filibuster.
So let's talk about the second era, I guess, of the filibuster, where sort of the that game that you just described on some level, that dynamic is sort of blown apart by the Civil Rights Act. And we move into sort of like phase two of trying to maintain that power by the elite, essentially, in a new era. Characterize that era for us.
Yeah, so this is fascinating. So, you know, much has been written about 1964 when Lyndon Johnson, as president, finally broke a Southern filibuster against civil rights. Now, to be clear, this was not the first time a civil rights bill had come before Congress. There were many civil rights bills that had come before Congress, like we talked about in the previous 80 years. This was the first time that they were finally able to break a Southern filibuster. Now, at the time, people thought maybe this is the end of the filibuster. Maybe the way that people saw it being used against civil rights will cause it to go away. Its association with segregation, its association with white supremacy will make it something senators don't want to use. But what happened against expectations was the opposite. It lost its association with segregation. It became sanitized and sort of entered the market like a generic drug. And when it entered the market, it found that demand was high because senators saw how powerful it had been against civil rights. And, you know, their issue might have been something else. It wasn't blocking civil rights. It was, you know, agriculture policy. But they knew that they could take the filibuster and wield it and create leverage for themselves in the same way the South had used it against civil rights. At the same time, a bunch of unintentional reforms started to make it much easier to use the filibuster. Before 1964, you had to use the filibuster in sort of the Jimmy Stewart style. You had to go to the floor. You had to actually physically be there, speak. You often coordinated with a bunch of other senators, you know, and you could hold and you could block, you could hold the floor and block a bill for as long as you had the stamina to actually be there and talk, you know. And this still had some connection to the idea of debate, you know, of trying to make your case, you know, still some connection to the idea of the Senate. After the 60s, a bunch of innovations happen. I won't get too deep in the weeds about what they are, but basically they gave every senator the power to wage a filibuster, to raise the threshold for passing a bill from a majority to a supermajority by sending an email or making a phone call before the days of email. All they had to do was signal to the cloakroom and signal to the majority leader that they were going to wage a filibuster against a bill. And the Senate's workload was growing so much by this point, the rise, you know, the expansion of the federal government caused the Senate to have a lot more to do, that the majority leaders, if they were warned that there was going to be a filibuster, they wouldn't bring the bill to the floor. And so it became much more user friendly. And so the point where we're at today is that not only do senators not have to actually go to the floor to wage a filibuster, they don't ever have to explain themselves. They can send an email to the cloakroom, and by that one email, the threshold for passing a bill gets raised to 60 votes. We've come to accept that as normal, and that's why it's sort of standardly accepted that it takes 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate, but that is not the way it was meant to be, and it's actually a very recent development of the past few decades that's even the case at all.
And the problem with this dynamic where you can wage a filibuster with the ease of basically, you know, getting a tee time, I guess, at a golf course, is that we just don't have we as in voters, as in constituents, don't have a sense of why certain bills aren't coming to a floor, the floor, or, you know, like we don't have a clear sense of who's advocating for what. Everything becomes much more opaque.
Right. I'm all for senators being able to delay a bill if they're going to go to the floor and explain themselves to the public. You know, that is in line with Madison's view of the Senate, that if it was supposed to provide a platform for persuasion. So if you were, you know, in the minority, if you were not, you know, if you were outnumbered when a bill came to the floor, you could go there and make your case. And if you could use your powers of persuasion to persuade people to come over to your side, you could win the day. But the point was, when that was over, if debate had been exhausted, the vote should come up and a majority should rule. Right now, we're having senators enable a minority to block everything that passes the Senate without ever having to even explain themselves. And so if they're going to want to block something, they should have to come to the floor. They should have to make their case. If they succeed, great, more power to them. If they fail, then the majority should rule.
Now, I know at the end of your book, you provide some suggestions for reform, but let's just truncate that. Should we get rid of, and at this point, under Harry Reid, I think, well, you served with him. He got rid of, in face of McConnell's really unprecedented obstruction of cabinet members, of judicial picks. He orchestrated the removal of essentially the filibuster, the killing of the filibuster for judicial picks and for cabinet members. McConnell subsequently did it with Supreme Court picks. Should we get rid of the filibuster for legislation as well? It's obviously not a, it's not something you can do unless you have at least 50 votes if you're Chuck Schumer. Would you recommend that, or should we just return to an era where the filibuster needs to be more mechanical, I guess?
I think that you should have reform that lowers the threshold to a majority. And there's different ways to do it. And you know, Senator Tom Harkin has had a proposal where you sort of ratchet it down over time, where after a certain number of hours of debate, say 5 to 10 hours of debate, the threshold goes down from 60 to 55, then eventually gets down to 50. So I have no problem with, you know, ideas like that, that keep the Senate to be a place where the minority will always have the ability to make their case and always have time to debate. But what has to happen is, as a standard matter of procedure, any bill that comes to the floor has to be able to arrive at a vote, a simple up or down vote, where it passes or fails. And so there's different ways to get there that I would support, but that has to be the end goal of reform. The reason is, if you flip it around, what you're doing by having a threshold of 60 is you're enabling a minority of as little as 41 senators, who again could represent as little as 11% of the American population, you're giving them the power to block everything. And so the goal of reform has to be to take away the minority's power to block anything the majority wants to do. Because in our era of polarized politics, where one side succeeds by making the other side fail, the minority is not going to be able to resist the temptation to advance their political interests by making the party in power fail.
And in between that is make the minority that is obstructing legislation, make them pay some type of political price in terms of, we need to justify this to the other 89% of the country as to why we're stopping this. So no $2,000 checks. Here's how why this is the case, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So, folks, I cannot recommend this book enough. Understand the dynamic between what people perceive as sort of dry parliamentary procedure and our actual politics that take place, as well as policy. So, all right, let's talk about at this point. Let's talk about the what's going on now. I mean, obviously, we've got impeachment in the House. It may go to the Senate for a conviction. Give me your take on Mitch McConnell's private musings that he is happy about impeachment, which we all just happen to know. Unmute him.
Sorry about that. Yeah. It's his private musings that made their way into the New York Times. You know, I'm not sure what to make of this. I mean, I'm reminded, you know, in February of 2016, there was a very similar story that reported that Republicans were preparing to abandon Trump. And it cited McConnell specifically saying he was planning to drop Trump like a hot rock if Trump won the nomination. So I think that there may be a little bit of reputation rehabilitation going on here. McConnell trying to make clear that he doesn't like Trump. He might also be, you know, this might be a high fastball designed to keep Trump on his best behavior. After that video yesterday where Trump came out and said, you know, basically continuing to encourage violence. So this may be an attempt to make sure that Trump quietly leaves office on January 20th. If it's true that McConnell is actively considering voting to remove Trump and presumably bringing along the 17 senators he'd need to do so, I think you have to assume that that is because McConnell thinks it is in Republicans' interests to do so. he's been wanting to purge Trump from the party this whole time. I think, you know, what people often forget is that the Tea Party was causing McConnell fits long before Trump even came on the scene. You know, the rise of people like Ted Cruz, of Rand Paul, whom McConnell opposed in the Republican primary for Senate in 2010, these people were driving him crazy and forcing his hand and forcing him into a lot of uncomfortable positions before Trump came along. So for a long time, McConnell has wanted to get rid of this wing of the party. I'm not sure that he will follow through, because the reason he is not gone through with this sort of dramatic action in the past is that it would basically trigger a civil war, hopefully only figuratively, among the Republican Party. It may not yet be the case that it is better for Senate Republicans' political prospects to get rid of Trump. But if McConnell goes through with it, I think what we can safely assume is that McConnell has decided that it is in Senate Republicans' political interests to get rid of him.
Yeah, and I think your assessment is that is my sense as well. And we should also say that, you know, McConnell could think it's in the best interest of Republicans, and he could be wrong. Like he could miscalculate. And so I guess we'll have a better sense of that within the next 3 or 4 days. Good for Chuck Schumer, who I am generally very critical of, for basically calling McConnell's bluff. We'll see how explicit he does call McConnell's bluff on this, because this is all really about extracting a political price from the Republicans based upon what they do or do not do, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, look, I hope they vote to remove Trump from office. I would love to see him go out that way. But let's not give them too much credit here. We spent 5 years of the Republican Party aiding and abetting Trump as he caused enormous damage to this nation and hurt countless people. So, you know, I hope they finally do the right thing, but it's about 4 years too late.
All right. So let's talk about this. I think, you know, to a certain extent, I hope this audience at this point has a broad understanding of reconciliation. We're going to have 3 bites at the apple in terms of reconciliation over the next 2 years, because you're only allowed 1 reconciliation bill per fiscal year. And it was not used in this current fiscal year. So there'll be 2 other fiscal years where a reconciliation bill is there. It can only be stuff that deals directly with the budget, and you only need 50 plus 1, really, I guess 51 votes to pass. But Joe Biden has just announced that he is not going to pursue reconciliation, or at the very least, he's going to pursue a bipartisan bill. Give me your sense of that.
Yeah. So you're right about reconciliation. It does provide a sort of end run around the filibuster. The downside of it is that it has very tight restrictions on what can be included. I think when you talk about economic issues, there's a fair number of things that can be used to move through reconciliation. It does basically exclude any sort of democracy reforms and things like DC statehood, which I think are essential. So it could be used in the beginning to rush something through. It's a long, complicated story. You might end up having to go nuclear anyway if you use reconciliation, because if you run afoul of the rules, you're going to have to use the nuclear option to change them, even if you go through reconciliation. But it's a fine tool, you know, to use as a stopgap while you try to do other things. But I think fundamentally, civil rights, democracy reforms, and DC statehood will probably end up forcing the issue on filibuster reform. As you said, Biden has said he's going to at first try to bring a COVID relief package to the floor under regular procedures, not using reconciliation. So that means you need 60 votes, just like we've been talking about here. I guess he's optimistic that he can get those 60 votes. If he can, you know, the things that he's been talking about for the aid package sound great. It sounds robust. It's going to include $2,000 checks. If he can get 60 votes for that, more power to him. What I'm afraid of is that when they don't get 60 votes, that they will water down the package. And if they bring this package to the floor and they're unable to get 60 votes, they're going to face a decision point. And they can either decide to make the package weaker, or they can decide to reform the Senate rules and pass the stronger version of the package on a majority vote. That decision point could come very early on. And I hope the Biden administration doesn't choose to deliver a worse bill and less aid in deference to these antiquated Senate rules with this deeply racist history. I hope that they get rid of those rules, restore the Senate to the way it was supposed to be, and pass the strongest possible aid package for Americans who are really suffering right now.
All right. So you and I share the same aspirations, but I want to get a sense of what you think, like, you know, like how sincere is Joe Biden here? And we should say, as a backdrop to this conversation, and I forgive me, I haven't quite matched up the timing, but I know at one point Harry Reid, when we were looking at the fiscal cliff, I think it was must be maybe 2010, I think it was going into there. The Bush tax cuts were sunsetting, and there was essentially advantage and leverage on the Democratic side. Harry Reid wanted to basically call the bluff of the Republicans. The tax cuts were all going to expire, and Democrats could have brought up legislation that said, okay, now we're offering tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts are all gone. Now we're offering tax cuts. Instead, the Obama administration, and from what I understand, the reporting was Joe Biden sort of like slid in, undercut Harry Reid's plan, which was essentially get like undercutting the Democratic leverage, and made a deal with McConnell that essentially allowed them to pay no political price, allowed them to keep a lot of like the tax cuts they wanted, did not get the stuff that the Democrats wanted. With that history, and I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong on it.
Yeah.
What is your sense as to like how much did they learn? How much did they want to learn from that? Is Joe Biden sincere, or is he just basically, this is what we have to do, you know, from my education in the 90s, to pretend to, I guess, Chuck Todd, that we're actually going to try and be bipartisan?
Yeah, I mean, that Chuck Todd point is really it for me. I mean, you know, the senators have to decide if they're in office to please Chuck Todd and to get approval from the pundit class, or if they're there to deliver results for the people who sent them into office. I'm not sure where the Biden administration is going to come down yet. I'm not sure that they're sure. I think that they still think, you know, choosing neither is still an option, that they're going to be able to both deliver big results and do it in a bipartisan fashion. And they're welcome to try that, but I think they have to have a plan B that they're ready to shift into very quickly. If cooperation doesn't work, they have to decide that they're there to deliver results and meet the enormous challenges that we face as a country right now. The fiscal cliff example that you bring up still rankles with me. I was there at the time, and I remember, you know, you're right. Reid drove a hard bargain with McConnell. There was a point where McConnell decided he wasn't getting a good enough deal for Reid, so he went to Biden. And I remember standing in Reid's office at the moment the White House gave him the deal that they wanted Reid to cut. It gave away too much for Harry Reid. This was the winter time. There was a roaring fire in his fireplace in his office. He just turned to the side and threw the paper in the fire. So this was like, you know, my final answer is nothing. And I think Democrats have to be willing to take that kind of hard line against Republican obstruction. When Republicans fail to deliver on the things that we need, Democrats have to be ready to take the necessary steps to deliver those results themselves.
Okay, so let's say hope springs eternal. Joe Biden is doing this performatively. He knows that Mitch McConnell's not going to get the deal that they want and that the American public needs. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to make it. I'm going to placate whoever those voters are in Ohio who want a compromise, and mythical ones, I would argue. He does that. And so then we're left with this idea of filibuster reform. How willing is it in your mind, and how much power does Joe Biden have to say, A, to Chuck Schumer, hey, look, this is pretty clear what we need here, and you're facing maybe a primary, so you have extra motivation to maybe do this, and I'm going to call Joe Manchin. And like, how much influence does Joe Biden have with Joe Manchin, or how much is it Joe Biden saying, like, Joe Manchin's there, I can't do anything, and so I'm going to have to give away the store to Mitch McConnell.
So Joe Biden has an enormous amount of power here, you know, and in some ways a unique amount of power, unique to him, because he has credibility on this issue with someone like Manchin, you know. And look, I look at this from the perspective of whipping votes, you know, which we had to do a lot in the leader's office. And, you know, I get that Manchin is firmly opposed. He's been very clear about that. But, you know, what you're talking about is a whip list of about, you know, 3 to 5 senators. So to me, I look at that and say, that's not a bad place to start. You know, you're not talking about a whip list of 15 to 20 people. So, you know, you can really focus your efforts on the people that you need to persuade. And Joe Biden, with his history of the Senate, you know, everybody knowing that this guy is about as deep as an institutionalist as they come, if he decides that reform is necessary, he is going to have unique credibility to go to someone like Joe Manchin and say, Joe, listen, you know me. I've tried everything. There is no other option here. We have to do reform. And I think that, you know, combined with other, you know, Manchin's issues, I think he's caught up in ideas of Senate history and reform that I think are incorrect. So I think, you know, helping explain the true origins of the filibuster, the fact that this was not the way it was supposed to be, you know, you combine those kinds of appeals with Joe Biden's unique credibility and persuasion. And I think you see a clear path to getting around to yes. It's going to take time. It's not going to happen right away. But if you only have a few senators standing in the way, I think that someone like Joe Biden is going to be able to persuade them if he chooses that that's what he wants to do.
Okay, so Joe Biden has this sort of like a Nixon to China ability to talk to a Joe Manchin. Is it, when Joe Manchin says no to $2,000 checks, and then he did a quick 180 on that, good for him. But when he says no filibuster, is he doing that? Is it your sense that he's doing that because I'm a deep institutionalist and I this is hallowed ground and I don't want to change the filibuster? Or is he doing that because this is going to mean that maybe some bills get pushed through that aren't necessarily comport with what my donors and my sort of class of people want. And I want that filibuster so that we can't go too far.
Yeah, I think
center of the debate as well.
Right, right. I mean, that's the thing is the irony of this is that if you got rid of the filibuster and enable the Senate to pass things at a majority vote, Joe Manchin will be the most powerful senator in the Senate because you can't get anything passed unless you have his vote. I think that that was not necessarily the case when it was possible the Democrats would control more than 50 seats. But I think now that things have settled where they are and you've got a direct 50-50 split with Vice President Harris breaking the tie, you know, Joe Manchin is empowered by this kind of reform. He can be the deal maker he wants. He can make sure that bills that he's uncomfortable with don't pass. You know, I'm not thrilled about that prospect as a liberal myself, but simply from an analysis of the power dynamics here, a majority rule Senate would put Joe Manchin in the catbird seat and enable him to be a total kingmaker on virtually everything that came to the floor. So I think those are the kind of appeals that over time will hopefully get him to yes.
So if I understand what you're saying is when Joe Manchin said months ago, I would be against the filibuster, he was not contemplating the notion of like, wait a second, I'm vote number 50 and I am literally the fulcrum of the Senate. And therefore, you know, I can get the Joe Manchin Stadium in West Virginia is going to look really good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, there's ways to get senators to yes. There's a lot more to his legacy than, you know, filibuster opposition. The other thing is, you know, the road to reform is paved with senators being on both sides of this issue. I mean, Harry Reid said he would never go nuclear. Chuck Schumer, you know, this is part of the, it's almost a rite of passage for senators to be on both sides of the issue. McConnell pushed to go nuclear and to deploy the filibuster reform when he was the second ranking member of the Republican Senate in 2005, when the Bush administration was making a hard push to deploy filibuster reform. So basically everybody's been on both sides of the issue. I hear what he's saying, but I don't see that as an insurmountable obstacle.
Okay. So lastly, let me ask you this. This notion, and we touched on it briefly, but this notion of the particularly this generation of Democrats that maintain the leadership in this party, their perception of who they must placate or whose judgment they must be in proper favor. The Beltway media, folks don't remember around here, but David Broder, that type of animal in Washington. That is, and I say David Broder, and people don't necessarily know who I'm talking about in this room, but that's indicative of maybe this is an era that is over. How much of a generational divide do you see within the context of the Senate, within the Democratic Party, about this particular notion of them having to address, I don't know, that we'd say the Chuck Todds, the Ledley Stahls, the Stephanopoulos, or whoever it is?
You have an entire generation of lawmakers coming up who've never spent a Sunday watching the Sunday shows. You know, I mean, and that's not, you know, due to their lack of engagement. They're incredibly engaged and informed, but the Sunday shows just don't set the agenda the way they used to. You have a huge generational divide here. And you look, Biden won the nomination. He won the election. But I think that's sort of papering over the fact that the rising generation of progressive lawmakers They represent the future. This is an inexorable march of demographics, and they are the people who are going to take the lead in the next iteration of the party. So it is incredibly important with these reform conversations for everybody to know that they have an enormous amount of leverage here. Lawmakers have to listen to them, and they should make their voices clear.
Adam Gentleson, the book is Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It's a fascinating read. I think it's incredibly important, particularly with a 50-50 Senate. I mean, these issues are going to have such an implication for people's lives on a material basis. Very important. Thanks so much for coming on. I would love to have you back to talk more as we see how this is going to plays out over the next month or two, actually.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right. I want to welcome to the program Rosa Books. She's a professor at Georgetown Law, Associate Dean for Centers and Institutes, the Scott K. Ginsburg Professor of Law and Policy, a former D.C. Reserve police officer and author of Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. Rosa, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Rosa. So,
congratulations on the book. Let's start with, I mean, and part of this is a memoir of sorts. And let's start with just sort of the how you got in trouble with your mom about this. Your mother is Barbara Ehrenreich, and she wasn't terribly well. First off, just tell us like how you went from a law professor, and then at one point you decided I'm going to be at least like a reserve cop.
Yes, I'm still a law professor. I wasn't completely nuts, so I didn't quit my job or anything like that. But I did become a part-time volunteer reserve police officer in D.C. And D.C., unlike a lot of places, actually has a program where you can volunteer to go through the police academy and you become a fully sworn armed police officer at the end, which I still frankly find kind of bizarre that they will let you do that.
Is Washington the only place where that's?
No, it's actually not. I think LA has a similar program. There are a handful of cities that do have similar programs, but in most places, usually a volunteer police officer just does things like helping out at parades or directing traffic. So it's relatively unusual.
All right, fair enough. And so you decided to do that. What? Why?
Midlife crisis.
in there.
You know, I can give you. That's probably the honest reason, frankly, but I can also give you a better reason, which is also true. Just maybe without the midlife crisis, it wouldn't have been quite enough. I mean, my whole career has been spent thinking and writing about the relationship between law and violence and ideas of justice. And I've worked on issues relating to policing, in fact, as well as military issues and so on in countries ranging from South Africa during the transition from apartheid through the Balkans and Afghanistan. And the book before this one was about, it's called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. And it was very much about the narratives and stories we tell about what counts as war, what doesn't, what violence is good, what violence is not good. And I was really fascinated at thinking about policing in the United States, which is obviously very violent compared to policing in most other developed countries. I was always just fascinated by the issue of, so how do cops make sense of being in this profession that's very violent? You know, what are the stories that they tell themselves when they get up in the morning about why they're going to work, and they tell their families and they tell each other? So it did seem like this incredible opportunity to kind of get a glimpse inside a world that is, for most of us, I think, so incredibly opaque.
Did you go in kind of looking at it from an anthropological lens and trying to make it more like, you know, let's look at this culture of policing and kind of understand it from, no?
You know, sure. I mean, I'm a writer. I go into everything with at least a little part of my brain thinking, huh, you know, this is kind of interesting. And I wonder if this is something that someday I might write about or grist for the mill in some sense. So I didn't go into it specifically thinking, I know I'm going to write a book. But sure, you know, that part of my brain that never quite turns off, the part of my brain that is a would-be wannabe anthropologist is always kind of, you know, chugging away there in the background saying, oh, that was sure interesting. That was pretty weird. And that's fascinating.
So, all right, just set the time for us as to when you entered, you're no longer a reservist, is that right?
That's correct. Okay. I stepped down.
So, just set the time for us when you went into the police academy, because obviously over the past
spring of 2016,
things have changed, at least in terms of the it seems to me. Society's sort of disposition towards the police, at least a significant segment of the population, is a lot more in tune to maybe problems of policing. And you went in right around the time of Ferguson.
After Ferguson, a couple years after Ferguson, okay. but then as now in 2016, as more recently, that year there were enormous nationwide protests over incidents of police brutality, police shootings in many major American cities, not on the scale we saw in the summer of 2020, but big. We also saw that ambush of police officers in Dallas, Texas, killed 5 officers by a guy who said he was motivated by anger about police brutality and police shootings. So it was certainly an issue that didn't dominate the news in quite the same way it did in 2020, but you couldn't go more than a week or so without headlines that related to policing and protests about policing and so on.
So that last part in terms of Dallas, let's talk about some of the things that you learned at the police academy, and both in terms of what you learned from the police academy and what you learned about the police academy when you were there. I mean, one of the things that seems to have really dominated your perspective was the general feeling of risk. I mean, I guess this actually bled into the patrols too, but I was struck by this because I had befriended a cop back in 2004, mm-hmm. in the wake of in the run up to the Republican National Convention in New York City, and this guy was convinced that the city was going to burn to the ground. They had been doing sessions where they were telling them like there was going to be this the risk. He was like in a frenzied state. I mean, he was a smart, smart guy, and you know, otherwise like a relatively calm individual. But he was. They had really riled him up that there was something really horrible about to go down. Yeah. And that you found that experience just in general. It seems like.
Yeah, no, I think that what struck me about being at the police academy was both what was taught and what was taught officially, what was taught unofficially, and what was never mentioned. And the bulk of what was taught sort of officially, part of the official curriculum, the classroom instruction, was tactical and operational. You know, it was memorize the list of property forms and what color pen you need to use to fill them out. Memorize the appropriate procedure for handcuffing a standing prisoner versus a prone prisoner versus a kneeling prisoner, memorize a list of vehicular offenses. That's what we learned. You know, lots of stuff to memorize, lots of tactics. What we didn't talk about was any of the issues the entire rest of the country was talking about: race and policing, violence and policing. You know, what is policing for? What should the role of policing be in a democratic, diverse society? We didn't talk about any of that, which was a really noticeable omission. And it's not because recruits didn't want to talk about it. I think there was, in fact, kind of a hunger to be talking about what the rest of the country was talking about, but we didn't. The unofficial lesson of the police academy is what you were talking about earlier, Sam. We really had sort of instilled in us a sense that anybody could kill you at any moment. And we would hear over and over, you know, there's no such thing as a routine call. Any situation could turn lethal in a millisecond. You always have to be prepared to face a lethal threat. You know, nobody, no matter how innocent looking, you can never let your guard down. Don't interview suspects in the kitchen because they could grab a butcher knife and stab you to death. Don't interview suspects in their living room sitting on the sofa because they could have a concealed weapon between the sofa cushions that they could pull out and shoot you. And we were constantly watching these videos of cops getting killed, cops doing a traffic stop, walking up to the car, somebody pops out with an automatic weapon, dead cop, cops walk up to a domestic violence call, guy opens the door, shoots them dead. And we would talk about these and analyze these for, you know, well, what could the police officers here have done differently? Could they have approached differently and so on? But the, you know, as you can probably imagine, the result of all of this was really, I think, to instill young officers with a sense of being under constant threat from every possible source, no matter how seemingly innocuous it might be. And that, you know, needless to say, well, I mean, I think it's worth saying police do get killed. It happens. You know, shortly before I started at the police academy, there was a young woman in a neighboring jurisdiction on her very first day out of the police academy, did go to a domestic violence call with a couple of other officers. Guy did pop out the door with a gun, shot and killed her, left two other officers seriously injured. That can happen. But it happens a whole lot less than police officers think it happens, statistically speaking. It's not very common. And yet, if you have these officers who go out into the world primed to view every single interaction as one that could lead to their death, that's clearly going to have a pretty big impact on how they interact with people.
I think at one point you suggested that the cops that you were with thought when you asked them how often police officers are killed, that they were like 10 to 20 times off.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a human problem. It's not a cop problem, right? Right. This is like you ask people how often people are killed by terrorists or how often children are abducted by random pedophiles at the playground. And they'll give you statistics that are ridiculously out of proportion to the actual threat. So in this sense, it's a human tendency to, you find out about one terrible incident like the one I mentioned where the young woman is shot and killed on her first day on patrol. And it's so shocking. You tend to think this must happen all the time, even though statistically it doesn't. And yeah, it's one of my favorite questions to ask cops, you know, how many police officers do you think are killed on duty every year, killed as opposed to die in a car crash or have a heart attack? And they tend to say, you know, 500, 1,000, 300, 800, 10,000. It's more like typically about 50, 60 people a year, which is terrible, but a whole lot fewer cops die because someone kills them than cops think.
What really struck me about that was not that people overestimated that the cops overestimated the threat to them in terms of dying, because I think, you know, we're going through that with COVID on some level. You know, it's like people, it's very difficult, but you would think for people whose profession is so oriented towards that would be like day one, everybody, you know, there would be some, you know, salty old cop teaching, you know, at the academy going like, look, here's the fact. 50 people out of the 800,000 sworn law officers this year probably are going to be killed in the line of duty. I mean, you would think that would be, was it your sense that maybe how conscious was the police academy aware of, like, that's not a bad myth for us to have in terms of what we want to motivate these,
it's interesting. I think that cops cling to that myth because, you know, it feels more glamorous and exciting to be in an occupation where you're constantly taking risks, you know? And so I think there's a self-serving element to that myth of, you know, hey, don't you dare question what I do because I'm the one who runs towards gunfire. You know, you can't possibly understand what it's like. But I also think, you know, when you certainly at the DC Police Academy, which I should say has changed in some significant ways since then. When you talk to the leadership there, they sort of say, yeah, we need to be letting people know that, yes, they need to be alert and situationally aware, but we also need to be letting them know that, you know, that's very rare that they're going to face a lethal threat, and that if they go into every situation acting like everybody's a threat, you know, I mean, what happens is obvious, right? At the extreme end, you get trigger happy cops who do what that cop who stopped Philando Castile outside of Minneapolis did a few years back. You know, Castile said, I have a legal registered firearm. I will show you the paperwork. He reached and the cop panicked and shot him. You know, and if you're primed to think everybody's going to kill you, well, then every time anybody reaches into a pocket or a glove compartment or a bag, you know, there's a danger that, that you shoot first and ask questions later. I think, though, the in some ways, the invisible harm of that, though, the harm that never makes headlines because it's doesn't find its way into police reports or anything else, is just the degree to which that mindset leads police officers, you know, to do more stops, more frisks. It affects who they stop and frisk. It affects their tone of voice when they're talking to people in ordinary interactions. And one of the scenes I describe in the book is going to a domestic violence call with a partner, a male partner, and a young woman, 16, 17 year old girl, she's in her own living room. She reached into her own bag to show my partner that she was the person who called 911. And he freaked out, you know, he grabbed her arm, he shouted at her, put your hands where I can see them. And, you know, she was like, officer, what are you, what is the problem? I'm cooperating. And it was fine. You know, there's no report, no harm, no foul on some level, but the invisible harm is, boy, that girl's not going to call 911 anymore,
right?
You know, because she got scared out of her mind by a cop who was jumpy. And that, you know, the fear, the humiliation that people experience when you have a jumpy, scared cop who screams at them, that is hard to quantify, but it's obviously, you know, an enormous negative impact.
I want to get into that more and talk about the your experience on patrol. But first, we should go back and just talk a little bit about the you mentioned that you think that the you know that the academy has changed a lot in the past 5 years.
Yes.
And the DC police force has also changed.
Yeah.
I'm interested in because a part of that was a function of essentially a consent decree.
Yes,
from
absolutely.
The DOJ. And so will you just tell us a little bit about that history, mm-hmm. and how you saw the implications, like, you know, yeah. what the implications of that consent decree did to the police department, how you saw that manifest?
Yeah. So by the time I started, I think most of the impact of the consent decree had already been felt. But late 1990s, Washington, D.C. police had one of the highest rates of officer-involved shootings in the nation. And as you said, that led to a Justice Department investigation and ultimately a consent decree that required the department to really revamp its training on use of force and its policies on responding to officer uses of force. So much so that around, I think it was around 2016 or 2015, when I started at the police academy, an independent auditor did an evaluation and essentially said, DC complied and no longer has a problem with excessive force. Doesn't mean there's none, but relatively speaking, right? Which to me, actually, when I talk to people, you know, a lot of my students at Georgetown are sort of police abolitionists and often sort of take the perspective, police reform is a mistake. It just sort of softens a system that is so terrible that softening it makes it seem more legitimate, and it's better for the system to be so awful that people just recognize that we can't have it at all. And my response to that is, you know, maybe someday we will get to a point in society where we don't have police. Maybe we can do that. Maybe we should do that. But we're not there yet. It's not going to happen anytime soon. And in the meantime, reforms don't change structural problems. It doesn't fix structural racism or anything like that. But reforms can save lives. And that's not, you know, that's not chopped liver. The other more recent change to the police academy, I think, you know, some of them, you know, one of the things that I did together with some colleagues, we started a program where we brought outside speakers into the academy, and we had a workshops for young officers, and they gave the police chief an earful about what they thought was wrong at the academy. And to his credit, you know, these young officers tend to be a lot more progressive than the older generation. And to the chief's credit, he made some significant changes in response.
Let me just ask one more question about the consent decree, and then I want to move on to your time on the beat. To what extent can we look at those things and, you know, the like a consent decree? And we should say that came out of the 94 crime bill, which it largely was, I think, you know,
terrible.
Some people at the time, but in retrospect, you know, atrocious.
Yeah.
But the the concept of, you know, the DOJ being able to come mm-hmm. in and at least impose certain guidelines and accountability. The tough part about sort of assessing that the efficacy of the consent decree is, of course, like the crime has gone down dramatically over the course of that same period of time. And people have different theories as to why that's the case. I'm sort of unleaded gas, proponent of that theory of just, you know, that it was generational, a function of lead largely. But how do we know that consent decree or do?
Yeah, no, you're right. That's fair. Overall in policing, it's extremely difficult to distinguish causation from correlation. You know, crime goes down. Nobody has the faintest idea, frankly, precisely what it was. And there are all kinds of theories, you know, lead paint and unleaded gas, you know, is one theory. You know, there are all kinds of others, and none of them can be definitively proven because there's just, you know, there's too many different things going on. And I think that is absolutely fair to say about consent decrees. That being said, both in DC and in a number of other cities with consent decrees, the correlation is sufficiently strong, even if you tease out some of the other factors like crime dropping, that it's highly suggestive that they're making a difference. Can we prove it, you know, 100%? Nope, we can't.
Did cops, in your experience, have a sense of like, I mean, it's one thing to be, you know, sort of trigger happy because you're scared and, you know, sure. I mean, you know, a rational person would say like, hey, you know, in terms of Fernando Castillo, why would someone who's going to reach for a gun tell me they're about to reach for a gun? They wouldn't do that. Right. If that guy wanted to shoot me, they would have not said I have a gun right. in the glove compartment.
Yeah.
But to the extent that there's any rationality, like, you know, when you've got your knee on the neck of somebody for mm-hmm. 6 or 7 minutes, and you have time to actually sort of think about what you're doing, how much do cops respond to accountability? Like, how much awareness? I mean, I guess it's sort of hard for you to make that comparison, but if there's a DA who's like, I'm gonna prosecute cops.
Yeah,
does that make a difference?
I think it makes a difference, you know, and again, I mean, this is same reason that I think consent decrees can make a difference. They're not the be all and end all, but, you know, if you've got lots of things combining to say to police, you know, you've got their chief saying, no, you cannot do that. You've got the trainers of the academy saying, no, you cannot do that. And, you know, DC, for instance, has not permitted chokeholds for a couple decades by internal department regulation. You know, if you've got the city council saying you can't do that, et cetera, you know, it adds up and you get a generation of cops who are like, oh, you know, we don't do that. You can't do that. So I think all of these things make a difference. Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's talk about your time on patrol. There was you were engaged in a lot of, I guess, like, I don't know, disturbing. I don't know how else to put that, like where you had to make arrests. Are you involved in arrests? I mean, you already just mentioned one where you know your partner sort of terrified the person who called the police. Tell the story about the mom that you arrested for.
Oh God, yeah, that was one of my all-time low moments as a reserve police officer. I mean, I should say, by the way, before I even tell that story, the DC police department is actually a pretty good one, right? Relative to big city police departments. It's a relatively progressive department. And most of the officers, I mean, you know, these are not sadists. These were sort of decent people trying to do the right thing. But one of the points that I often make when I encounter people who say, well, we just need to get the police to abide by the law and respect people's constitutional rights. That's a pretty low threshold. And a good police officer who abides by the law, conscientiously respects constitutional rights, can still do a lot of harm, you know, and that I think is one of the things that this particular incident really, really highlights. You can have cops who aren't doing anything wrong, and yet the whole system is so fundamentally flawed that even good policing can really mess up people's lives. So this was an incident. My partner and I was at the very end of a shift. We were had just responded to a burglary alarm call in a store in a strip mall, and we were sort of sitting in the car, you know, writing up the report. And I glanced out the window and I saw a security guard who seemed to be having a fight with someone, you know, a big scuffle. And I said, oh, you know, what's going on over there? So we both jumped out of the car and we ran over. And by the time we got there, you know, the guard had won the scuffle, had gotten the better of his opponent, who turned out to be a tiny little woman who looked to be in her 60s or so, although I later found out she was younger than I am. Just a hard life had aged her. And we said, what's happening? And he said, well, she shoplifted, and she had kind of a wheeled sort of cooler bag. And he opened it up and we looked inside of it. And there was a big multi-pack of frozen chicken thighs and a big package of laundry detergent. And the woman by now is, you know, just crying quietly and saying, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it. I'm sorry. So we all go back into the supermarket and my partner and I look at the security guard and we sort of said, you don't want to press charges, do you? We don't need to arrest her for this. She's shoplifting necessities, you know? And the security guard was like, yeah, no, we don't need to arrest her for this. This is, we're going to bar her, which basically means, you know, formally telling her she can't come back to that store, but that's all we need to do. But then in the meantime, while this conversation is happening, my partner did exactly what a conscientious police officer is supposed to do. And he ran her name and so on, and he found that she had an outstanding warrant. And that then changed the situation. It meant that we essentially had to arrest her. We moved it from a situation where we had the discretion to just say, you know, give her $20, direct her to some services, say, please don't steal. You know, there are other services available. Maybe, right? We hope. Maybe not. And let her go. And turned it into a situation where we were required to arrest her or potentially face, you know, some sort of internal discipline ourselves. And everybody was, we all felt shitty about it. You know, the security guard, my partner, and I think my partner sort of wished he hadn't done that check. And he was like, you know, I shouldn't have checked. Now I've checked, I can't uncheck. And it's in the records that I've checked and she's got a warrant. So we arrested this poor woman, you know, and she said to us, you know, my grandbaby was hungry. That's why I was shoplifting. And, you know, we sort of tried to mitigate the awfulness by, you know, having her call home first and, you know, make sure there was somebody else available to take care of the child and slipping some cash into the bag with her property in it. So when she came out, she'd have a little cash and making sure her phone was turned off. So it would have charge left when she came out. But there's no getting around the fact that, you know, this woman who was nonviolent, you know, clearly had substance abuse issues, and was just desperately poor, was now going to spend a night in jail, causing whatever knock-on problems for the rest of her family. And frankly, the bench warrant that she had was almost certainly, and I confirmed this later, for something just as trivial, you know, a shoplifting of a few hundred dollars or $50 of necessities. And that's how you get people who just bounce around the system. You know, the sort of revolving door of misery and arrests and short stints in jail and fines that they can't pay. And it, you know, just pushes them even further into poverty. You know, so there was absolutely no way that arresting her either helped her, didn't help the store. The people in the store didn't want to arrest her. It didn't help anybody, didn't help the community, her family. And yet, technically speaking, it was a textbook model of good policing, right?
So, and just to be clear, and just to tease out that sort of revolving door aspect of it, she gets cited for, let's say it was shoplifting one other time before, and she's got to pay a $50 fine. She obviously, if she doesn't have the money to buy some chicken, she doesn't have any money to pay for a $50
fine. She's just got to show up at a particular court date because she doesn't have transportation and, you know, she can't get there. And so then you get another summons. And
it becomes like a multiplying effect, right? I mean, it becomes even more, the hole becomes bigger.
Yep.
And there's no new factor in which to help her out of the hole as it is.
That's right. And that in turn is why, you know, a lot of what's wrong with policing can't be changed by police. It's got to be changed by the rest of us. You know, I mean, there are plenty of things about policing that police can change, right? They can change the training. They can change the recruiting. You know, they can change how officers are evaluated and how shifts are structured and so on. But they can't change stupid laws that over-criminalize and over-penalize trivial infractions. they can't change prosecutors, they can't change judges, they can't change the legislators who we elected, who passed the stupid laws. You know, there's a lot of things about policing that is going to take a concerted effort by all of us to change, because unless we do change those things, you can have the best cops in the world and they're working within a system that is going to continue to harm people and communities.
So that's the reform versus structural change argument right there, right? I mean, it is one.
I don't think so. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I wouldn't call them versus. I think it's reform and structural change.
Right. Okay. But I mean, the point being that it doesn't matter how good these cops are.
Right.
We have a structural problem.
It doesn't matter how compassionate they are, how conscientious they are, how committed to respecting constitutional rights they are. They're working in a system that hurts people because of the way it is constructed in ways that cops have very little control over.
And so let's go into that concept of like what, presuming that we can do all the reforms that we need to, you know, and it does sound like, I mean, there is a shocking, and again, you've said that the police academy in DC anyways, in 2016 has, you know, changed, but it does sound like there's a shocking absence of sort of like the type of training that you would think that somebody would need to be interacting with the community.
Yes.
And maybe you can speak to that for a moment as to what that could be. But then I want to talk about the other side of the ledger, which is like from a structural standpoint, if you get that super, you know, sensitive cop who is aware of like, I'm able to, you know, put danger into perspective. I mean, I just don't know if there's like 800,000 people in the country who are ever going to get to that point, frankly.
Yeah.
But what would be some of the key reforms? But then let's talk about the structure stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so, okay, we could go on for quite a long time, so I'll try to be really brief here. We could start with recruiting. Most cops in most places are whiter than their surrounding communities. That's actually not the case in DC, but it is in most major cities. They tilt very heavily male. Only about 12.5% of all law enforcement officers nationwide are female. There's pretty compelling evidence that women do police differently and better in many ways than men do. Many departments recruit. This is something we have our students do. We have them look for YouTube videos that departments use to recruit. And it's astonishing how many police departments think a great recruiting video shows people, you know, smashing down doors and tackling fleeing suspects. And guess what kind of recruits that's going to attract? Exactly the wrong kind. So all sorts of things about recruiting, you know, where the investments in recruiting are, who is recruited should change. Training, absolutely, that there should be much more in-depth training about the neighborhoods and communities people are operating in, about the ways in which structural racism has distorted our system, about what we know and don't know, and mostly it's don't know, about what causes crime and what types of policing might improve things or make communities better off. And as I said, the answer to that is mostly we don't actually know. And cops should know that, right? That's actually something that they should be thinking about. Et cetera, et cetera. So lots of things about training. The way shifts are structured, it varies tremendously from place to place. But in DC, the way shifts are structured, there's never any sort of built-in reflection period of like, well, how did that call go? Could we have done that differently? You know, what do we learn from this? Doesn't really happen. The way people are evaluated, you get a medal if you do CPR and save somebody's life. But it's the sort of dog that doesn't bark in the night problem. Nobody gets medals for having de-escalated a situation, you know, and kept something from getting out of hand. So how we think about figuring out how to recognize those things. So all of those kinds of things, I think, are really important in terms of the tweaks cops can make to policing. But yes, they don't come close to getting at any of the big, broad structural problems.
And one thing I did find fascinating is when you talked about both white and black cops would look at, and you were in 7D, which was a heavily policed district,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
That they perceived the the people living in this district as animals. And the idea that they had no, and they blamed them for their situation. And the idea that they had no sort of like a historical context in which these things here, I mean, it is a, you know, I have conversations on this program with, like, you know, libertarians or whatnot who have the exact same sort of no concept of, like, well, yes, I mean, we're not all similarly situated. I found that fascinating, but I know you have a limited time. So let's talk about the structural things. Let's talk about, like, that concept of defund the police. I don't think you would subscribe to the idea that we should have no police, but it certainly sounds like you would like to make their portfolio much, much narrower.
Yeah. And I, you know, I don't think that was a great slogan, defund the police. I think that the slogan people sort of move towards, a kind of reinventing public safety, reimagining public safety, is the right idea. And that's partly because I don't think this should be about budgets. It should be about strategy. You know, that we can't fix policing just by taking money away. You know, then we'll just have fewer police doing the same crappy things. And it won't magically give us, you know, a core of social workers who are empowered and skilled to respond in effective ways or anything like that. But I think the conversation we should be having is, you know, where do we want to be in 10 years and 15 years and 20 years? How far away from that are we right now? What will it take in terms of investments, in terms of training, in terms of recruiting, to begin to get us where we want to be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years? And let's start that process right now. All that being said, you know, and I do think absolutely there are lots of things cops do that you don't need an armed officer to do. It's crazy to have armed officers do. Most societies don't have armed officers doing. You know, we have armed officers enforcing civil traffic regulation violations. We don't have armed officers who, you know, come to your door if you miss an IRS deadline. You know, why do we think they need to come with a gun if you made a right turn on red when the sign said you shouldn't? It's nuts. But I should say, we can do all of those things and it still won't affect the deeper issues. And you alluded to them a minute ago, Sam. You know, why do we have high crime in this particular neighborhood? Well, you know, you actually have to start thinking about the restrictive covenants that forced African-Americans into that community and out of other communities. You have to think about the preferential tax benefits that led supermarket chains to locate in wealthier communities and not in poorer communities. The decisions about bus lines and subway lines and public transportation that have left many poor communities far away from the places where the jobs are, with no easy access to them if you don't have a car, and so on and so forth. You know, that the reinventing public safety, unless as a society we start getting serious about the ways in which both racism and other forms of economic inequality have created areas where there is a lot more crime, we're still not going to solve any problems. And that's a, you know, multi-generational challenge, not one that we're going to solve in even the next 20 years.
I guess lastly, do you still have a lot of friends on the force? And I'm also curious, like, your partner, were they like, I don't want the volunteer?
You know, I told some stories in the book about some bad examples of policing. Most of the officers I met were decent people who really were trying very, very hard, often failing, but trying hard to be decent people. And so, yeah, I do still have friends, and I work with a program that is a collaboration between Georgetown and the DC Police Department that, as I said earlier, you know, brings speakers and does workshops for young officers and so on. And it's actually, you know, to end on a positive note, the younger generation of officers do give me hope, because they do tend to be much more progressive than the older generation and much more interested in thinking about how to change policing from within. So that's something that does give me hope.
In DC, at least.
In DC.
Yeah. Well, Rosa Brooks, the book is Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Back. All right, folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, that is it for us this week. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And for those of you who are still here, hello.
That's hello. The Trump bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Hello. Hello. Want to remind you, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out Just Coffee, folks. They got the Majority Report blend. That's my weekday blend. That's my weekday blend. But they also have teas and chocolate. You know who is a big fan of tea? I think our next guest is, actually. He is here on phone. Want to make sure that, okay, good. All right. And let's bring him on, ladies and gentlemen. He is the host of the David Feldman Show. I also believe he may be an Emmy Award, well, maybe nominee. I don't think he's ever won one.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, David, you're speaking on a phone. Are you speaking anywhere near a phone?
Yeah, can you hear? I'm having one of those weeks. Can you hear? It's like we live in a third world country.
All right, well, you need to speak. Now? Yeah, we can hear you. Just got to continue to speak into the phone.
Yeah, it's one of those weeks. This is a third world country. Broadband, it's pathetic.
Broadband is...
How do I sound?
You sound like you're calling on a cup with a string, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, let me try it this way. I hate my life. I just... Everything... Hang on. I'm really sorry about this.
Well, no, you seem to be doing okay. Hang on. That's fine. David, let me just ask you this.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. We can hear you.
Okay, I'm really sorry about this, but this is the country we live in, Sam.
No,
the infrastructure. It's the infrastructure. And I'm just, I have no internet. The broadband in my apartment building is clogging. Yeah, I have dial-up, but the building has broadband, and so it makes the dial-up even slower. Anyway, hi, Emma.
You're calling from a phone.
It's a dial-up phone.
I just want to ask you, did you say that you have dial-up internet?
Yeah. Yeah, I live simply.
You live in New York, though, right, don't you? Or you live in a major metropolitan area, let's put it that way.
If you think New York City is a major, for you, you would, you know, New York is a major metropolitan area because you're a bit of a hick. So, yes, you would come to New York City and think, wow, this is a big city. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm in a bad mood.
No, I could see that. I could see that. But I'm just struck by, well, now I'm struck by two things. One, that you have dial-up internet, which, I mean, I haven't even heard of anybody who lives anywhere that is, like, you know, where there's a neighbor within 15, 25 miles who has used dial-up service in over 20 years, A, and B, what city do you consider big, if not New York?
Well, I'll tell you, a city that's getting too big is Washington, D.C.
Too big for its bridges, huh?
Well, you know, Emma, I'm sure you have broadband because, you know, it's all, let's get the newest thing. Let's, you know, let's spend money we don't have. Let's get broadband because I can't wait 5 minutes to download The Guardian. You know, and this is the problem with our side. You know, this is the you know, we're all on the same team. We're Democrats, we're blue, no matter who. I'm a Marxist. You pretty much know that I'm a Marxist, right?
You're Marxist from way back, almost like the time of Marx.
I'm a small government Marxist, and this is not working. This is not working. What's going on in Washington right now, Pramila Jayapal, I like her, but she is the leader of the Progressive Caucus, and she is a bad cop. She is a rogue cop, and she murdered that beautiful bipartisan infrastructure bill last night. It's lying in a pool of blood right now and it's on life support and she just wants to kick the ventilator out and watch it die. And we gotta stop her and Bernie, who I love Bernie, but this is an embarrassment. This is a disgrace.
Well, they just didn't take the vote yet.
They humiliated Nancy Pelosi. Humiliated. And it looks bad. They're making the Biden administration look bad. And they want a civil war. Bernie, and I love Bernie. I love him. But I look at the Democrats. It's a crack up. It's like Israel. I look at the Democratic Party and it's like Israel, Sam, Emma. We're looking at Israel, and it's a
death. How so?
Well, the progressives are the Palestinians, and then you have the moderates, Manchin, Sinema, Gottheimer. Who doesn't love Gottheimer? He solves a lot of problems. I cannot tell you how many times I've called. I grew up with Josh Gottheimer. He's a problem solver. And sometimes I can't, the Wednesday New York Times crossword puzzle, call Josh Gottheimer, Biden, Schumer, they're the Israelis, right? And this party's going to be destroyed because both sides need to come to the bargaining table and compromise. The moderate Democrats, like the Israelis, they have to be willing to give an inch. And the progressives, like the Palestinians, have to be willing to live in an open air sewer. Otherwise, the whole thing falls apart. And I just don't think I'm not optimistic about the Democratic Party. I'm really disappointed with Bernie and Pramila Jayapal. They want everything. They're like the Palestinians. They want drinkable water, housing, medical care, food for their kids, schools, economic, socioeconomic mobility. Yeah, yeah. I mean, where are the adults who are going to say to these progressives, yes, who doesn't want that? But you have to give and take. It's all compromise. And I don't think this is what Bernie and the progressives understand. I'm not a child, Sam.
I know you're not a child.
I would like faster internet, but how are we going to pay for that? How do you pay for this?
Well, I mean, you tax it. You tax.
Okay. See, tax and spend. I told you I am a small government Marxist. I don't believe in tax and spend. And I don't think taxing solves. Okay. Big Pharma, negotiating with Big Pharma on Medicare. It's a good idea, right?
It's a great idea. It doesn't even involve taxing, but it would raise.
Exactly. How are you going to pay for that? How do you pay for negotiating with Big Pharma? You can't tax that problem away. That's nothing to do with taxes.
Now,
how are you
going
to pay for that?
David, I think you're confused about the dynamic here. When you negotiate.
Oh, now it's a personal tax. I'm confused. Now we're attacking me. I don't like the tone of your voice, quite frankly.
I think maybe that's your phone. Maybe your phone is just it's because I'm just trying to explain to you that with the negotiation, Medicare negotiating with Big Pharma about the drug costs, this is the government paying for these drugs for people on Medicare. It could save $600 billion over the course of 10 years.
Of course, but how do you pay for it if you can't tax it?
Well, you pay for it with the savings that you're a child.
I don't mean to be condescending, but you're an infant. All I hear is goo goo gaga, mama, mama, mama. Mommy, where's my breast milk, mommy, so I can feed off the teat of big government.
I got to tell you, I can't tell you how strongly I wish that we had cleaner audio of you saying that. But that's not the point. David,
you're saying my audio isn't clean? You're talking my audio?
I'm
a guest on your show, and you're saying I have dirty audio?
No, I'm not saying you have dirty audio. I forgive me. I apologize. That was out of line.
And I'm all for clean audio. Climate change, okay? You're a child. And don't take this the wrong way.
Right, no.
You do not – don't take this the wrong way, but you're – You haven't developed yet. And climate change, okay?
Right.
I hate the oil companies. You know that.
No, I know that. Of course.
I loathe the oil companies.
You hate them.
And and we are subsidizing. We are giving billions. And I read The Intercept. Do you read Ryan Grimm in The Intercept?
Yeah. In fact, we just interviewed him on the show.
Well, did he tell you? Did you know that our government is subsidizing the oil companies, that we literally give, you know that, Emma?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's insanity. That's fiscal insanity. The climate is falling apart and our government is giving money to Exxon, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So theoretically it would make sense to cut the subsidies to big oil, right?
Right.
Well, practically,
how do you pay for that? How do you pay for that?
Mm-hmm.
How do you pay for that?
How do you pay for
How do you pay for the cuts? How do you pay for not giving big oil those subsidies?
Well,
sure. If the world smelled like cinnamon, and all we had to eat was cupcakes, I would be for cut the subsidies to Exxon. But you can't tell me how to pay for it.
Well, you don't need to. When you stop paying somebody, there's no expense associated with that. There's savings.
I'm sorry. I just hear goo goo gaga, mommy, I'm hungry, whip out your government teat and feed me. That's all I hear from you infants.
That's all I hear.
Now it's me now, too, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's like grow up.
Turn, David.
Cutting the Pentagon. Yes, 20% off the top of the Pentagon. Great idea. How do you pay for it?
Well, did you David?
Yeah, I feel like
you're being purposefully obtuse in some way. I mean, I think people are familiar with the concept that when you are paying for something and you stop paying, let me put it this way. Do you pay for your dial-up internet?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Let's say you decided I'm not going to pay for my dial-up internet. I don't need the internet. I'm watching Matlock. I get it on over air TV or, you know, Murder, She Wrote or whatever it is.
10 o'clock, Murder, She Wrote, 11:30.
Right.
Yeah.
So you cut your internet. Do you have to pay for that?
Again, I'm not trying to be rude. You sound like a one-year-old child who has been sucking off the government teat for 60 years, and now your diaper is full and you're cranky.
But how could I suck off the government teat for 60 years if I'm 1 year old?
All right. You're just an egg. You know, the thing about the left, and I am a Marxist, but you're vicious. You're vicious. That's the problem with our side. You are on my side. I mean, you're vicious. The way you talk to me, the way Emma, I hear Emma laughing at me. And I've watched her demonize Joe Manchin. That has to stop. I mean, it really.
Well, what did you think about him on his yacht? Saying that we're going to tax the rich and the celebrities, which I think you should probably be a little bit concerned about.
Yeah. You're talking about heaven? His yacht.
Almost heaven. Have you been there?
I call it heaven because that's where Lindsey Graham caught COVID.
Oh.
So to me, that's heaven.
Yeah.
That was... I have a problem with Lindsey Graham because I'm a Democrat.
Right, of course. Of course.
And I don't, and I, you know, and I don't mind demonizing the other side, but don't demonize our team. Joe Manchin is on our side, and he's my brother. Is Joe Manchin your brother?
No.
Is he a Democrat?
He's not my brother. No, but let me ask you this, Dave.
Well, you're saying he's a woman? You're saying he's your sister?
No, I'm saying he's of no relationship to me.
He's your brother. He's part of our family, the Democratic family. And you and Emma.
But he is going against. Now, wait a second. No, wait a second. I want you to address this because I let you like filibuster for a long time. Like you monologued on this quite a bit.
I suppose you want to get rid of that too, right?
Well, I mean, based upon this experience, I certainly do.
All right.
Well, wait, just let me. Can I make a point?
Go right ahead.
You are blaming.
Take the pacifier out of your mouth.
You are blaming. I'm just going to ignore your. I mean, you're getting insulting.
Not me. You're my brother. If you're still a Democrat, you're my brother.
Listen, you claimed that the progressives were, going off on their own. They are defending Joe Biden's agenda. Right. This is like pre-negotiated. They are. This is the agenda that Joe Biden signed off on. It is Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema who are obstructing.
My sister.
It's your sister and your brother who are obstructing.
My brother.
Your sister and your brother who are obstructing the entire Democratic administration's project, essentially.
What are you talking about? There's an infrastructure bill waiting to pass. It's
but
sitting
that's,
there.
That is literally 1/6 of the agenda, and it's really not even as poignant as the rest of the agenda.
It's something.
But how is that even remotely like equitable or fair to Joe Biden, who I imagine in your mind is like your older brother, maybe your dad.
He's your dad, yeah.
Who's
your daddy?
Hang on. You kids want instant gratification. You pass this bipartisan infrastructure bill, right? Right?
Right. Okay.
Well, I want to see where you're going with this.
For the
before
sake of
I
argument.
Agree.
And let's see if we like it. Before we get another kitten, let's see if we like this cat first. Let's give it some time. And then if you take care of this infrastructure bill and you're responsible and you change the box, then maybe we'll talk about Bernie's bill. But first, prove to me that you can handle this bipartisan infrastructure bill that was carefully pruned and shaped by Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I mean, Joe Manchin, he's not your enemy. I mean, you have to have somebody to demonize. The man represents West Virginia. You know, I know you coastal. I know that Emma, I think according to Jimmy Dore, cul-de-sac. Is there a cul-de-sac in your life?
I've heard rumors of a cul-de-sac, but really it's just a suburban street line.
Well, I watch Jimmy Dore. That's where I get my information from. Mm. And he accused you of being a cul-de-sac, as I remember. I don't know what a cul-de-sac is, but that's a big word for Jimmy Dore to use, cul-de-sac.
Well, it's actually, so. I mean, to be fair, it's three words. But
wow, did he accuse me of being a cul-de-sac?
I think I heard there was so much vitriol and saliva and misogyny spewing from my hero, Jimmy Dore, when I think he was using a French pejorative. I think he said, Emma is a cul-de-sac. That's what I heard. Listen,
you're right.
I don't pay it. Listen, when it comes to Jimmy Dore, it's not what he says. It's how he says it.
Right.
It's the music. It's not the lyrics. The point is he hates women. That's what
Look.
I don't know. Maybe you're a cul-de-sac. Maybe you're not a cul-de-sac. The point is you've never been to West Virginia the way Jimmy and I have.
I've been to West Virginia.
Have you walked along the Appalachian Trail with the Appalachians? Have you talked to the people of West Virginia the way Joe Manchin? Have you talked to? I'm not a cul-de-sac. Okay, mm-hmm. I talked to the people in West Virginia with their bloated bellies, and they live in cardboard shanties, and I sit down on their dirt floors and ask them what they need. These are Joe Manchin's constituents. And you know what they want? Fiscal responsibility. That's what they want. But you wouldn't know that because you're a cul-de-sac.
You have a point there. I never sat on the floor of a West Virginia shanty.
Okay. So you're saying, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. You seem to have taken like a little bit of a turn here.
I'm saying it's give and take. Okay.
It's give and take. If you're talking about, $4.5 trillion worth of spending, that is proposed, wouldn't the give and take be somewhere around 2.75?
The give and take is,
or I should say, well, 1.7. I mean, I guess, 2 or 2.25, I guess, maybe.
Okay. First of all, you know nothing about negotiations. Okay. You can't have give and take at the same time. So somebody has to
take. No, you have give and take at the same time. That is exactly what happens.
You cannot give and take at the same time.
Well, one party one party could theoretically give and take at one time, but you cannot have give without take on the other side. I mean, two parties.
They're two parties, but in any relationship, at one point somebody is giving and one point somebody is taking. And now is the time for our side, you know, the Marxists, the leftists in the Democratic Party, to give, and the Godheimers should be allowed to take. And then when we see what they've done with all the stuff that we've given them after a couple of years, then it's our turn, assuming, you know, we have a majority in the House and we still have the Oval Office, then we can take. But you can't give and take at the same time.
So you've got to give a lot before you can take, is what you're saying.
Yes, right. But
David, do you think that there's going to be an opportunity anytime soon to have the scenario you're talking about? I mean, it's very likely.
We have an existential threat. Donald Trump, we have the most important midterms coming up of my lifetime. Our democracy is at stake. I think all of us should be willing to go without to save our democracy. I don't think children need health care. I think they should be willing to give up their health care, their food, and live on the streets. We all have to sacrifice for democracy. And you're not part of the greatest generation. Compromise, okay? The infrastructure, bridges and roads. Do we need the roads? I like bridges. Bridges are beautiful. They're a testament to man's ingenuity. Do we need roads?
Well,
why does it have to be bridges and roads? Why can't it just be bridges?
Well, I mean, theoretically, you need to get to the bridges. But I mean, if you're suggesting that maybe we do, I don't know, some type of train upgrade, I'd be okay with that.
You know, I'm amazed at your stupidity. Bridges and roads. What's on a bridge? What do you drive on when you're on a bridge?
It could be a train.
If you're driving over a bridge, what's below your tires?
Oh, road. If I'm driving or if I'm riding, because I can do both.
I don't know why you would take mass transit. That seems inefficient.
I take the train quite often.
Well, that's congratulations for your virtue signaling. Yes.
That's not
congratulations.
It's not virtue signaling. Yeah. I'm taking the train.
Okay. All right. You don't need bridges and roads. There are already roads on bridges. This is government waste. If you would think the before you spoke.
All right, so David, let me just, we've got to land this here. So I just want to be clear on what you're advocating. You think that it is incumbent upon the 50, maybe more, Democrats in the House to capitulate to the 8 or 9 corporatists in the House and the 2 in the Senate.
Yes.
You think they should capitulate to them?
For the time being.
For the time being. And what do you think that time frame should be? Give me just a rough ballpark.
Let's see what happens with this bipartisan infrastructure bill first. Bernie's,
you're suggesting wait 4 or 5 years at least, maybe more, do stuff like negotiate with, prescription drugs. Like, for instance, what does building a bridge?
How do you pay for that? You keep bringing that up.
Well, you're okay with paying for the bridge,
but not the roads.
Compromise.
It's all about compromise.
Well,
I see your point now.
You know what? There's this. It's cute. There's a delicious naivete that I. That's why I like watching your show. I once said famously that watching a bill pass through Congress is like watching a sausage getting made. Because it's more effective than Viagra for me. I said that. I find it very intoxicating to watch a sausage getting made.
Wait a second. You're famous for saying that watching legislation get. Are you building something in your house?
I have a houseboat. I have a houseboat. And we're remodeling the houseboat.
All right.
I said that. Yeah, it's like watching a sausage getting made. And Bernie Kilbasa, can I be indelicate here? Do you mind? Because it's lunchtime. I don't want to get people salivating. But Bernie's $3.5 trillion Kilbasa. As eye-watering as it is, I think it's scaring a lot of Americans. They look at the size of Bernie's kielbasa, and they say, "You know what? That's going to hurt." I can handle Bernie's kielbasa, but most Americans are going to look at the size of that $3.5 trillion sausage and say, go stick that in some other country, not here in America. Right. Maybe one day, maybe when we're older, we'll have an appetite for a larger kielbasa. But Bernie, it's gigantic. I'm not saying Bernie's kielbasa isn't appealing, but you don't jam a $3.5 trillion kielbasa into a country that's barely 250 years old.
Listen, David, it has been a pleasure to have you on today. Appreciate your insight into this. It's it has been insightful
we're all brothers and sisters, and I'm a Marxist. I'm a small government Marxist.
You're a small kielbasa Marxist, and Bernie's too big for you. I get. We get it.
Well, just read Karl Marx. Okay.
Right.
It was Karl Marx who said the government doesn't create jobs; it destroys jobs. That's what Karl Marx said. Or maybe it was Ayn Rand. Who wrote The Fountainhead? Was it Marx or Ayn
Rand? Marx.
It was not Marx.
She's joking. It was Ayn Rand.
I just wanted to see where that went.
Yeah, David, I mean, just
you
thank
met
you.
My son Rand. Did you meet my son Rand Feldman?
I did not.
How about my daughter? How about my daughter Milton Friedman Feldman?
Yes. She's lovely, I'm sure. David,
she is.
Well, do you want to, when's your show on?
I don't come on your show to plug my show. Right.
Well,
that's not why I'm here. I'm here. I'm here because
you're our brother.
We're brothers and sisters,
yep.
And we just need to go slowly and ignore the suffering of others. That's all I'm asking the Democrats to do, is block the suffering of others out of your mind.
Well, words to live
by. That's how we move into the light.
David, always a pleasure. Yeah.
Peace. Be kind to others. Be kind to others.
Thank you, David.
That's how I sign up. Be kind to others and ignore their suffering.
So that you're not overspending on them. So
yeah. Live within
your means. Yep.
Yes.
David, thank you so much for your
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's not
a lot to think about.
A lot to think about with that.
Good to have a Marxist back on the show, though.
Yes, it is. It is nice. Nice.
Bring
full
some
on.
Left voices on.
Full right? on. Get that. Yeah. Well, David Feldman, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what to tell you.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive between the 101.